In a landmark decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 forbids discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender. How does this decision change the lives of the LGBTQ community? Joining me today to discuss this decision's impact are Outward Magazine publisher and Rainbow Chamber of Commerce CEO Fred Palmer, LGBT Center CEO David Heitzeman, Muganzo Entertainment CEO Melissa Muganzo Murphy, and Uptown Studio CEO Tina Reynolds. Melissa, I'd like to start with you. How are the daily lives of the LGBTQ community going to be different after this decision?
Well, I first think it's important to recognize the intersectionality when we talk about LGBTQ accessibility and rights and momentum. When laws are passed, we tend to think of them in groups. How is this one group going to survive? How is this one group going to be affected by this decision? When in reality, people encompass so much more to the identity. So you're talking about how do Black folks from day to day navigate momentum? How do Indigenous folks, how do people of color, how do people in society exist when landmark decisions like this are made? So when we're talking about queer rights, trans rights, LGBTQ accessibility, we're really talking about how is the world moving forward? And so what this did is provide legal protections for folks to be able to exist in workspace, in home space, and in the outside community and feel comfortable in their skin and be able to say, I can showcase my partner at work. I can showcase my family members and be okay and feel like I can exist in this world without feeling like I have to hide anything. But in reality, before this case, LGBTQ folks were out here living and thriving and moving forward. And probably your favorite activist is probably identified as an LGBTQ person, because we have been taught that we have to live in the shadows to be able to move forward. But this land case is allowing folks to live freely and openly and really celebrate all of who they are fully.
Fred, I see you nodding your head vigorously. How did you react?
Well, you know, I think it's a powerful moment for many of us that are older. You know, in the beginnings of my career, like many of us, you hid yourself. You became a chameleon and you survived to thrive. You know, this landmark movement, this landmark decision before it, only a handful of states had protections. We here in California are very lucky and privileged at our statewide laws. But on a national level, you can look at a map and see the handful of states that had some protections prior to this, and now it is the law of the land. You know, I've been in situations in the past where I had a boss tell me that it was more appropriate for me to have a picture of my dog on my desk than my husband and I, my boyfriend at the time, because we couldn't get married.
Really? Wow. Well, you know, that also raises, Tina, the issue that... it's a bit of an interesting world, because while at the same time the Supreme Court came down with this decision, almost within the same period of time, there was a new federal rule that was proposed that essentially said that a person who was either transgender or identified in a way that was different than his or her biological identity and self-identified differently could be barred from federal housing facilities. And so it almost sounds like that there's a mixed message going on. You think?
Yeah, I think that there totally is a mixed message. And what about trans rights in the military service? I think that we move forward and then we're pushed back, and we move forward and then we push back. It's the same that the Black community is going through now, except today all the queers need to support the Black movement so that we're using our sources, the fights that we've done, to help elevate our Black brothers and sisters. Housing, it's like Fred said, you go back, it's just 20 years, and we were all afraid of being fired for being gay in our businesses. We were fearful of buying a house. We didn't have the same rights if our partner passed. It's changed so quickly for the queer community. it's almost magical. It seemed like it took forever, but now if you have hindsight and you look back, it all happened so quickly. These are rights that I got so many comments from people that said, I thought you already had that. I thought that that was already the law of the land, which means that we have a greater public acceptance.
Well, and David, this actually goes to something that you had shared with me before, which is that in celebrating this decision, this really deals with the employment area, but there's so much more that maybe many of us assume has already been addressed and hasn't. Mm-hmm. What are the limitations of this decision, and what is it that's left undone?
Tina's right is that a lot of people, a lot of the country, in fact, has already believed that we as LGBTQ Americans have these rights and that we should be entitled to these rights as equal community members to everyone else. The unfortunate reality is that there's a cultural change that continues to need to happen within the systems in which we all kind of go to work and we go out to access healthcare and housing, as you just mentioned, because transgender folks who identify with one particular gender or another, or have no gender identity that is aligned with the binary, they may be denied service in a sex-segregated shelter, or may be denied healthcare from a doctor, either a mental health care professional or their insurance company, depending on where you live in this country. We are very fortunate here in California to have had the experience and have laws that protect us in these different areas for some time. However, at the center every day, we continue to hear from people who continue to be discriminated against and who are being harassed at work and who are being denied healthcare procedures that they are entitled to by law. And so while this shift with the Supreme Court is a decisive decision in favor of non-discrimination that really indicates that the country has come a long way, that the American people are with us, it also reminds us that there is work left to be done to ensure that cultural shift and the laws that govern the land across America, not just here in California, continue to change.
And Melissa, what David raises in terms of where the country is, it's kind of interesting. Among many commentators, they remark that for Neil Gorsuch, and for this court to take a position like this on this particular court decision, was highly unexpected. What does that say about how far the country has come with regards to LGBTQ issues, and how much further it has to go?
Well, I appreciate David's comment about talking about there's still so much work to do, because again, when we think about progression and movement, we tend to think about them just very, very isolated groups. And we can't be free until everybody is free. So until our trans, our non-binary, our intersex folks have the same access and visibility and support as folks that identify within this binary or spectrum, we have not fully won. And that includes folks that are homeless or unhoused. That includes folks that are disabled. That includes folks that identify as people of color. That includes folks that are considered low income. All of that is wrapped around in all of these movements and these momentums and these passing of these historical bills. So I think that it's very important to highlight that this is a landmark decision to provide more access and visibility. But safety, right? Safety, protections for all, thinking about all with everybody in mind is really the work. And so I think this is a great indicator that more conversation, more honest conversation about the work that's left to do is welcome versus feeling like we have to work around and put in these like buzzwords and fluff words to make people feel more comfortable. And that's
when you talk about buzzwords and fluff words, a real word that you mentioned that I don't think many people understand is intersectionality. You said intersex, but intersectionality. Can you go dig a little bit deeper and explain to all of us exactly what that means and what its importance is? And if anybody wants to chime in afterwards, please feel free.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll definitely allow my counterparts to join in on the conversation. when we think about who we are as people, based on some of these laws or documents that are provided federally, we tend to categorize people, right? We used to say, what is your sex? What is your gender? What is your race? Where are you from? How old are you? And then we say, based on these categories, we then make assumptions about who you are and what rights and privileges you deserve to have, right? But we know that that narrative is based on an institutional idea that folks don't get to have such privileges if they fill out a box a certain way. But intersectionality means that you don't get to pick and choose which part of you deserves more. All of you, you represent all of who you are at all times. So I'm 100% everything that I encompass. 100% Black, 100% queer, 100% woman. I'm 100% all those things at all times. And I don't have to pick and choose which battle, which law, which moment, which momentum, which movement I want to be a part of, because all of these movements affect me in many ways. And so that's what intersectionality is about, is looking at you as a whole person instead of this categorical ideal of this part of your identity is the most important today.
Would anybody else like to comment on that as well?
I would, Scott, just to say that, I mean, I completely agree with that. And what this ruling really helps with is that it allows you to show up at work with all of your identities, with all of yourself, and to say that for you to know that you are valued in your employment situation and that you're seen by your employers in your authentic way and your authentic self. People don't think about the ways in which the stress that's caused from hiding different parts of yourself or trying to fit in or trying to not get noticed or to try to alter the way that you work or you speak or you think in ways that will be more acceptable to those around you. And so this ruling really says that you can show up to work as your true authentic self. And that really, I hope, makes people feel more comfortable day to day, but also more comfortable filing a complaint and saying, this isn't okay. It's not okay for people to say this to me. It's not okay for me to be excluded from this. And I deserve that promotion just like my colleagues for the same kind of work and or for the same kind of pay. So all of those things are really critical to allowing people's mental health and physical health and their economic viability to show up in ways that are important in alignment with the value of themselves as a human being.
Okay.
I'd like to jump in on that as well, if you don't mind. I think from a corporate perspective, it's up to all of us to educate and train our population and the corporations, speak loud and powerful with our dollar power. I think it's up to us to educate the rest of the community, for example, things like pronouns. Not too long ago, many people were not understanding or even knowing what pronouns were or using them. And so many of you on this call and myself, we've started using pronouns in public to educate folks of what that means. So when I go to a Rainbow Chamber mixer and my name badge has my name on it and it has my pronouns, it opens a conversation. So it makes the other people looking at my name tag wonder either silently or verbally, what does that mean? And it gives us an opportunity to open a door, or open a window to educate the corporate America folks on why that matters and how important it is that we are there and we're visible. And that we're not only visible for ourselves, but we're visible for everyone else and representing our trans brothers and sisters or people of color. I mean, everybody. It's up to all of us to do this together.
Mm-hmm. Tina, I want to come back to something you said a few minutes ago about supporting, you know, other efforts like the current Black Lives Matter efforts and things like that. How do you see that the ongoing effort for equality among the LGBTQ community, you know, partners in with and sort of works alongside on and I'm going to use Melissa's word that she's, you know, explained a bit more intersectional, on an intersectional basis, so that folks are working together. Is that relationship working?
Yeah, the relationship is really working. We've come a long way. When we were talking about Prop 8 in 2008 and it passed, the reason that we lost is that we were not out enough and we didn't solicit the friends of ours that were African American or Black or Latino. We didn't really make sure that you, Scott, knew that I was queer. I mean, you and I have had conversations where I said, well, I want to hire some Black people. And if you ever need to hire a queer, call me. I mean, those are the relationships that we need to build with each other. I don't care what represents what group you represent. I want to meet with the whole you, that intersectionality that you bring each time that I see you. As employers, we have to interview the whole person and not care about all this other stuff in our lives. It's like, can you bring your best self to do the work that matters to me? And do I not care about all this other stuff except in a way to help support and build you? If an employer can support and build each of their employees within the community that they spend most of their time in, they're going to be smarter and more well-informed, and the employee is going to feel supported and elevated. If it's what we're doing at Uptown Studios. The whole person, it's not just the whole queer person. When I first started my business, we had 10 people and 8 of them were queer. And I went, oh, okay, I need to diversify some. We can't be a totally queer company. And so since then, I've started adding different ethnicities and cultures, and I'm better for it. Intersectionality is so important to the corporate world. And I'm just a small business, but if corporations embrace that aspect of each person, they're going to be so much better.
And actually, you know, that raises a question, Fred. You come from corporate America, and as the head of the Rainbow Chamber, you have a number of businesses who want to affiliate with the Rainbow Chamber and its memberships because, frankly, you represent dollars. At the same time, one of the criticisms that's going on right now with the Black Lives Matter movement is there's a lot of corporations who are putting up particular signs or writing particular letters. But then if you look at the underlying conduct, it doesn't really walk the talk.
Yeah.
I know you're a business guy, but how do you respond to the fact that there's a big disconnect sometimes between the public aspirations and pronouncements and the day-to-day conduct?
Sure. I think corporate America is always targeted different groups of folks because that's who they saw as their audience. Long ago, you know, early pioneers that sought out the gay dollar with their brand were very powerful. They sought out and asked for the gay dollar. That was really hard to find back then. Now we're seeing rainbow everything. So, you know, it's nice that you see a shoe company or a coffee company with rainbow, 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 and they throw some support at Pride, let's say, and that's great. We love that. But we need them to do that all the time, all the time. The same as Juneteenth last week. Juneteenth became a movement that everyone threw their money and their messages at Juneteenth. That's great that they did that, but they need to do that every day. They need to make that a part of their corporate structure, within their hiring practices, within their diversity and inclusion, donating to causes that make sense, that matter, doing it with boots on the ground at a local level, allowing the regional managers of those corporations to be involved, be on a board of directors, volunteer time, encourage their staff to do the same. So it's not just about putting a rainbow flag up on your masthead. It's about speaking what you're going to do. How are you going to support all of our community and all of the rainbow of the LGBTQ+++?
And it's not just...
Oh, go ahead, Tina.
It's not just speaking of it, it's doing it. I mean, you need to speak about it and then you need to do it. And you need to talk about how you're doing it and reaffirm that those messages.
You know, David, another disconnect that has sort of bubbled to the surface from time to time is that within the LGBTQ movement itself, and this goes all the way back to Prop 8, is that a lot of times the leadership looks more like 1950s America than some would say 2020 America. How is the community doing in terms of making sure that all of the voices within the community are getting their turn and their representation at the table?
Sure. I mean, I think that we're doing better, but we have a long way to go. I mean, I am a gay white man. So I sort of look like a lot of what corporate America's leadership looks like, a lot of board leaders look like, a lot of movement leaders look like within the LGBTQ community. And I truly hope that a black transgender woman takes my place when I am out of this office. We're doing actually a poor job in the nonprofit sector of building a leadership pipeline of folks who are ready and prepared and given the opportunities along the way to prepare them for those leadership roles. And that's part of the systemic oppression that exists within society, right? So if folks don't have access to healthcare and education and housing at younger ages as children and then as adolescents and are not affirmed in school and don't see images in representations of themselves that are positive in their textbooks and in their on television and in various parts of society, if those things aren't giving those individuals like an inspiration to reach higher and do better, they're less likely to think that I can do that. And then there are also everyone else in society is also less likely to believe in them and invest in them and to put them onto a path in which they can be successful and be leaders in our society. And the reality is that America is built on this notion of white supremacy. And I, as a white person, benefit from that unconsciously, even if I myself and every day I might fight those unconscious biases. The reality is that I still benefit from them. And so that has placed me in a position of power and leadership that I hope that we working collectively in very intersectional ways. I mean, it is incredibly important that queer folks show up right now with Black Lives Matter at protests and show up at state capitol buildings and at the nation's capitol to lobby and work toward policy changes that help set us a standard, sort of a bottom standard, frankly, of the minimum that we must do. But we as a society and Americans need to have a wholesale shift in the way that we think about the world and the value that we place on people of color and on value that we place on transgender folks and non-binary folks and other queer folks who really have a lot to bring to the world. And I think that the nonprofit sector in particular, but this is absolutely true in the for-profit sector, in business, and in government, we need to do a lot better job of supporting folks into a leadership pipelines because those individuals have great capacity to lead. And we sometimes just need to get out of the way.
Melissa, I want to come to you because you've spoken about this before and have spoken a lot about who's not at the table right now. And while I've heard you talk about this with regards to the LGBTQ community, you actually even tied it back to whose deaths were recently focused on and whose weren't as an example. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Absolutely. And what I wanted to make sure we bring to the forefront is that at the height of the movement, we need to understand how media has played a role in how we view ourselves and how we view society. So when we think about liberation, we have to take it back centuries ago, right? The need for liberation and equality started from our native and indigenous folks, right? It started with our Black folks that were enslaved saying like, this isn't right. And then people supporting that movement along the way, but forgot to make sure that everyone was free. And as privilege was attained by folks that identified as white, they forgot that other folks were in the need for liberation from the very beginning. And so I appreciate David's comment about privilege and power and how that shows up. And I want to second that by saying media also has followed in appropriating that same narrative that queer folks look this way, transgender ability looks this way, our view in society about who deserves and who does not deserve looks a certain way, but media has controlled that narrative and it's really been shaped and deeply rooted in white supremacy to keep those narratives about folks going. And so when we think about George Floyd's passing and rest in peace to George Floyd, we have to think about this. Other folks, our Black trans folks are dying at high rates, right? We have even women identified folks that are dying and they're not getting the same opportunities in media that George Floyd is getting. And while George Floyd's death has been a huge catalyst in us moving this liberation forward, it's not the first time that we've lost a Black identified person, right? It's not the first time that we lost a trans person. It's not the first time that we lost a person to a hate crime. So it all matters. It all matters. But media has really taken ownership and needs to do a better job of taking ownership on how we see ourselves and how we see this movement. I even think about the DACA ruling, which is a huge ruling, but how that still plays a role in both queer liberation and Black Lives Matter. When we are all of these movements at once, right? And when we think about who's not at the table, it really is, who are we looking at our current table? Do we know how everybody at our table identifies? Have we even taken into consideration that people at the table are more than what we know to see? Or are we using our own biases to view our own table? Because let me tell you, the table is encompassing of so many different identities. We just haven't given folks the liberation to say all of you was welcome to the table.
Okay. Fred, I want to come to you and ask you, there's been a lot of progress. If you go back from the days of Stonewall up till now, and there's certainly a long way to go. But I want to start with you, but just go around the horn real quickly. Buttigieg ran for president. How long do you think it'll be, and just very quickly, how long do you think it'll be before we see our first president from the LGBTQ community?
You know, if it's the right candidate, I'm ready for that person now. But I don't
okay.
want to vote for someone just
okay.
because it has to be the right candidate.
All right, now, Tina?
I think we need to have a queer woman. Then we get both of those at one fell swoop.
By when do you think?
I think in the next 4 years.
All right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. And that's our show. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syphax. See you next time, right here on KBIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KBIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.